The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about getting fetal DNA from a mother's blood. How exactly does that work, Dave?
Well, Rob, researchers already knew that fetal DNA floats around in a mother's blood while she's pregnant, but it's in really small amounts. And researchers up until now have had a really hard time both isolating that DNA and also trying to distinguish that DNA from the mother's DNA, because as you can imagine, they're very similar. And so what doctors do now, if they want to try to figure out if a kid's going to have some sort of genetic abnormality, they do either a test called an amniocentesis, which they stick this very large needle basically into the woman's belly, take out some of the amniotic fluid, and then take the DNA from that. Or they also can do something called chorionic villus sampling, which sounds even more invasive. They basically pluck a snippet of tissue straight from the placenta. And as you can imagine, both of these techniques are fairly invasive, but they also have another downside, which they can slightly raise the chance of miscarriage. So even though we learn a lot from these techniques, they're not 100% safe. And so researchers have been saying, well, we know there's fetal DNA in the blood, and obviously taking blood is fairly uninvasive and very safe. Is there a way to use that fetal DNA instead of taking it via these other methods?
So a new technique then for separating the mother's DNA from the fetus's DNA based on just a withdrawal from the mother's blood.
Exactly. And really what the advance is here is the researchers here did much more powerful sequencing than had been done before. They used the most cutting edge sequencing technology, and they really sort of went to town on these mother's blood samples. And using this method, they were actually able to get a significant amount of fetal DNA, so much so that they knew that they had the entire fetal genome represented in the sample. And also there was enough DNA to allow them to very effectively distinguish between the fetus's DNA and the DNA of the mother and of the father.
So what's an example of something that they've found using this technique?
Well, Rob, in this study, they only actually have only tested this technique in one patient. So it's very early days. But what they did was they went to a mother who is carrying a genetic mutation for a disease called beta thalassemia. And this is a mutation that can lead to severe anemia. And interestingly, both the mother and the father had mutations, but neither of them had the disease. They were both carriers. But the problem is if both your parents are carriers, there's a decent chance that you could actually wind up with the disease. And this is something that people would want to test for. And so the researchers applied their new technique, and sure enough, they were able to sequence the fetus's DNA. And fortunately, they found that the fetus also had this mutation, but the fetus only had the mutation on one gene. So the baby, turns out, is going to be a carrier as well, but will not have the disease. And they confirmed their method by going back and using one of these older methods, the chorionic villus sampling, which also confirmed that the baby was a carrier for this disease, but wouldn't actually have the disease. So even though this was with only one patient, they were able to show that the technique, at least in this one woman, was as effective as a much more invasive technique.
With the kind of coverage, a full coverage of a fetus's DNA from sampling the mother's blood and going to town on it, as you say, it doesn't sound like this is going to be something that's going to be clinically available because of the expense.
That's true. It's still very early days. This technique is very expensive. Now, researchers expect the cost of sequencing techniques like this to really come down in the next few years. So as far as the cost issue, hopefully in a few years that will be resolved. But there are some other issues that experts bring up. One of them being, right now, even if you were to spend all this money, this technique returns so much data because you're dealing with basically the entire genome, that it's more data than doctors know what to do with. And some experts are concerned that, yes, this will give us a lot of data, but will we really know what to do with this data? But experts say that if this does work out and they do work out the kinks with this technique and they do work out the cost issues, this could be really powerful, not only for diagnosing diseases like beta thalassemia that was done in this study, but also for other genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis and Tay-Sachs and other diseases. So theoretically, this is a very promising technique in a few years for determining the future health of your child.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from peeking into a fetus's DNA to learn more about its genetic code, to peeking into the complexities of whale communication, this next story is about how some whales mimic the calls of other whales.
which whales in particular are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about killer whales, otherwise known as orcas. And these whales, like a lot of other cetaceans, which includes other whales and dolphins, have very complex forms of communication. They make a variety of sounds that seem to indicate that they're talking to each other. Of course, we obviously don't understand what they're saying or what these calls mean. But what researchers have noticed in some bottlenose dolphins, which are a relative of whales, is sometimes these dolphins will mimic the call of another dolphin. Just like a parrot might mimic something you would say, a dolphin would replicate a squeak or some other sort of noise from another dolphin. Now, that's just been seen in captivity. And this whole mimicking behavior is actually very rare in the animal kingdom. We know that some songbirds do it. And now we know that these dolphins do it, but only in captivity. But studying it in the wild, especially when you're talking about underwater in the wild, is very difficult. You've got all of these whales together, and they're making so many different noises, and it's hard to tell who's mimicking who because it's really hard to keep track of these whales. So this is something that's been very hard to study in the wild.
So these whales that this research team is studying are not in captivity.
They're not in captivity. They're actually killer whales that are found off the coast of Vancouver Island in British Columbia. At least that's where the researchers studied them. And what the researchers did, because this is so hard, was they followed this pod of whales for a long time. And what happens is you have these groups of whales that sort of stick to their own group. So you have, say, one pod of whales, and sometimes they'll associate with other pods of whales, and sometimes they do that for mating or to build alliances, but then after a while they break off. So they followed this one pod of whales as it interacted with other whales. They did a lot of measurements of the whale's calls. They analyzed the calls with sonograms, which gives you really specific information that allows you to compare one call to another. And what they noticed was that one of the foreign pods of whales would make some calls, but when they left, the original pod of whales that the researchers were following seemed to sometimes mimic those exact sounds that the foreign whales had made. And a lot of times when mimicry has been seen in animals before, it's usually when the animals are right next to each other. So you're sitting next to me, Rob, and you say something.
Say something.
Exactly. Then you just mimicked me, but we're in the same room. What was interesting in this situation is that the whales seemed to be mimicking these foreign whales after they left.
So kind of like I pick up a phrase that you might use a lot, like go to town.
Exactly. Like go to town. You might start using that. But it's not just the phrase you would be using the same. You would actually say it in the exact same way that I said it as well. And that's what researchers thought they were hearing here. For example, here's what the foreign whale call sounded like. And now here's the mimicked call from the original group of whales. Foreign call. Mimic call. And you can hear they're not exactly the same, but they're very, very similar. And what the researchers found was that about one out of every 500 calls were mimicked calls, not necessarily that mimic call that we just played, but they were basically recreations of a variety of different types of calls that these foreign groups had made.
Is this helping researchers figure out what these calls might mean then?
Well, right now it's really just speculation. The first step was showing that the whales actually make these calls. But again, the interesting thing here is that they're making the calls, they're mimicking the calls in the absence of the other whales. So that could suggest a couple of things. It may be a way of referring to that group, or maybe it's a way to communicate something about that group's family members, you know. But this is really just speculation. The researchers know that the mimicking is happening. They're just not sure what it means.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from a newly discovered type of mimicry to a newly discovered type of vision cell in the eyes, this last story is about a very rare type of cell in the eye which may help us see.
So not the rods and cones, but something else.
Exactly. For a long time, the dogma in the vision world has been the what are called the photoreceptors in the eyes that help us see are rods and cones. If you don't have rods and cones, or if there's something wrong with your rods and cones, then you're blind or near blind. And the rods and cones are the end-all be-all of vision. That's what's so interesting about this study. Researchers have found that a type of cell that's only been known about for about 10 years, which is called a melanopsin-containing retinal ganglion cells, or MRGC.
A neuron.
It's a type of neuron, but it's very rare in the eye. Only a very small fraction of the neurons in the eye are these types of cells. And even though they've been known for 10 years, they've never been linked to vision before. Researchers thought they had to do with our sort of reflexive responses to light. So if somebody shines a light really bright in your eyes, your pupils constrict. And the researchers thought these MRGCs were responsible for that. But they didn't think they had anything to do with our ability to see. Again, that was all chalked up to the rods and the cones. But in this new study, they showed that these cells do seem to play some role in vision. They seem to allow us to see perhaps shadows and perhaps different shades of light. And the way the researchers found this was all done in mice. And they tried to find what these cells were connecting to in the mouse brain. And they found out that these cells were extending axons. These are sort of the stringy extensions that come off of neurons. These axons were poking into a part of the brain called the lateral geniculate nucleus. And basically, this is the part of the brain that is the relay station for visual information. So the researchers said, well, you know, if these guys aren't important for vision, why are they interacting with the vision center of the brain? That was the first thing. But then they took mice that were genetically engineered to not have rods and cones. So these mice should have been blind, but these mice still had the MRGCs. And what they found was that when they shined varying intensities of light on the mice, when the light was very intense, like daylight, this part of the brain, the lateral geniculate nucleus, became very active as if it was processing visual information, even though these mice theoretically shouldn't have been able to see because they didn't have rods and cones.
So they help with sensing variations in brightness.
That's what the researchers think. They say it might be something like you and me being able to distinguish between a dark wall and a brightly lit doorway. So these are not subtle cues. They would have to be very broad types of visual cues, like something very bright or something very dark. But that is still a type of vision. And what's important about this paper is it's saying that's a type of vision that we apparently don't need our rods and cones for. There's this third type of neuron in the eye that's giving us that ability.
Does this suggest a potential target then for therapy for people who are blind and helping to restore sight?
Well, that's a great question. And a lot of blind people have problems with their rods and cones. But these researchers say, well, if they don't have their rods and cones or they have problems with their rods and cones, but their MRGCs are still intact, then maybe that's something scientists could target. And probably wouldn't give these people vision, but even being able to distinguish light and dark could go a long way in helping these people better adapt to the world they live in. But that's speculation at this point. The researchers don't yet know, first of all, whether these cells perform the same function in humans, and if so, what sort of therapies they could design based upon these cells. It's just promising research at this point.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got another whale story, this one about how whales feed themselves, especially blue whales, which are the largest animal on Earth. They expend a lot of energy trying to get food. And this story is about how do they make up for all that energy they expend. And also a story about whistling caterpillars. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about an annual international test that tests science and math abilities for countries all over the world. And you can find out where your country ranks by checking out this story. And also about a new institute that's being created at NIH that will help the government agency spur the development of drugs and medicine from basic research. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.